Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. It is Dave C. from Bel Air, Maryland.
Hi, everybody. My name is David, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you all. Thanks to Dave for inviting me to come and speak. It's not my favorite thing to do, I'll tell you that right now. But I do it, excuse me, because I'm asked, you know, and that's what I was taught. To never say no to AA, and AA has saved my life, you know. And I know that's the only reason that I'm here tonight, right now. So, a little nervous to decompress here a little bit, you know. You know, I never think about what I'm going to say anymore. You know, I did that my first couple of years. My story is so long. I drank and drugs while I was 41. I never tried to get sober, never wanted to get sober, never thought that I would be sober in my life. So I experienced a lot, and I chased life to the fullest. And so it's kind of always hard to put my story together as far as chronological years and all that stuff. And I used to tell my story, and I would get in my head a lot about the bad things in my life and get depressed while I was telling my story, you know. Not very entertaining. And so, anyway, I just stopped doing that. I stopped thinking about what I was going to say. It takes all the pressure off of me. My ego doesn't like it too much, but, you know, too bad. You know, it's always, you know, when you're sitting out there, it's never a big deal. You know, somebody standing up there, just a guy sharing his experience, you know what I mean? It's another child of God. But my ego makes a real big deal out of this. You know what I mean? It is really putting the pressure on me to perform. What are they going to think of me? All that silly stuff. And it starts about halfway here. Excuse me. Let me take this jacket off. It starts about halfway here, and it starts out like little whispers, you know, telling me this and that. You know, what are you going to say? How are you going to put all this stuff together and all that stuff? And that's how my ego talks to me. It's these little whispers. You know, and sometimes it's really, really believable to me because it's my voice and I've been listening to it my whole life, and it's a lot of negative stuff. You know what I mean? It's always negative unless it's telling me I'm the best. You know, so I come to realize that most of life and most of my thinking is usually somewhere in between. You know what I mean? So, anyway. My buddy Brian said, don't worry, if you bomb, I'm going to fake a seizure, so we'll let you off the hook that we brought up here. So, always bring some guys. Got a really close friend of mine, my house manager at my halfway house that I have. Two guys that are in my house. Always keep some new, fresh guys with me, and I just love it. You know what I mean? It's just something that I've really incorporated in part of my life. It keeps me fresh. I never get sick of giving this back. You know what I mean? My sobriety date is May 15th of 2005. Okay, I have a sobriety date. I have a sponsor. I've been through the steps at least 3 times. Thinking about the steps process is always beneficial, always a growing experience for me. You know, every time I do it, learn something new. Not as uncomfortable the second and third time as it is the first time. You know, I had a sponsor who's probably sponsored half the East Coast, and he has taught me to be God-dependent, not sponsor-dependent. You know, and that's where I'm at today. And it took me a while to get there, you know, because I need a lot of relearning and reteaching how to live, you know. But that's where I'm at. I've got a home group, and I get the speakers from my home group, and I like that. It gets me out and about. And I didn't get sober just to sit home and have a humdrum life, you know. And AA is everywhere. It's not just in my town. It's everywhere. And I like it. We chase it like we chased everything else, you know. And we have a saying in my house that we talk about, that we're partying on life's terms today. Not just living on life's terms. We're partying on life's terms. And we're partying on God today, you know. It's just silly stuff that I think is really cool, you know. And it's not the things that I thought were cool when I was growing up, let me tell you. So a lot has changed. You know, I was taught to share what we were like, what happened, what we're like today. Since it's only one up here, this is going to be what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. Stories change, everybody's got a story, circumstances, and all the details doesn't really matter. So I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland, in the city. I lived in the city until I was like 9 years old. My father, that I know now, was probably an alcoholic. He died when I was 12 from drinking and driving. So I grew up in the house that was, you know, drinking was acceptable. You know, there was a bar in the basement. The basement was a club basement. There was a bar down there. But besides the circumstances of how I lived, it was just more about how I felt as a kid. I had a pretty normal childhood. You know, I remember I was really hyper. At an early age, I was very self-willed. You know, I was like 4 years old. I was climbing out of my crib and actually leaving the apartment building and getting my own cereal and all that stuff and not waking my mother up. And so at an early age, I kind of did what I wanted to do. You know, and I really didn't worry about the consequences too much either. So, but as far as like all the normal stuff, being insecure or comparing out and all that, comparing myself to other people, I think everybody does that, you know, at an early age. It just depends on how much of an extreme that I did that. And as a kid, I don't remember doing it that much, you know. I was competitive. I was, you know, I was self-centered to a degree, like we all are, you know. I wanted to be the best. That was one of my things, a belief that I had to look at, you know, as I was recovering, you know, what made me think that I always had to be the best? You know, where did this perfectionism start? You know, and it could have been just from my mother saying, just do your best in a baseball game or something. You know, and those things stick in our heads. So, but I always had that drive to be the best, I know that. And I did have that feeling like, you know, comparing myself that I wasn't good enough a little bit and to certain people, you know, if I wasn't number one, it wasn't good enough. But other than that, I had a pretty you know, healthy childhood. You know, I had a brother that was 6 years old, 6 years younger than me, a sister that was a year younger than me, was born on my birthday. Playing football in the alleys, you know, playing kickball, hide and go seek, all that stuff. It was just normal. Sleigh riding in the golf course, you know, and stuff like that. And we moved out to Harford County, actually where I live now. My parents moved out to this town called Falston, built a house out there. It was a brand new neighborhood out in the country. There was nothing out there at all, a state park, and I didn't want to move out there. I liked it where I lived. There were like gangs, you know, type of people around where I lived, and I remember thinking that was exciting. You know, they played football against each other, and I remember even at an early age, like 8 or 9, remembering about people smoking pot. You know, the hippies down the street and stuff. But those were things that I was never going to do, you know. And I will tell you this, that I remember that age when experimenting with sex at a very early age, 7, 8 years old, and thinking that I'm definitely going to hell, you know. And I'm definitely a recovering Catholic as well. But that's the God that I prayed to. It was a punishing God. You better look out, you know. And if you do too many things, you know, God's going to forget about you. And that's kind of what happened to me. But I had a lot of guilt and things piling up from things that I was doing wrong, you know, because I was rebellious. I was like 9 or 10 years old. My parents moved out to the country. Anyway, I adapted pretty well, and it was pretty neat, you know, building tree forts and just all kinds of stuff, you know, mingling with the other neighborhood kids as people were moving up. Everybody was moving out of the city, okay? Now that place is just thousands and thousands of houses and communities and stuff. But the turning point in my life as far as when my addiction really started taking hold and my alcoholism was when my father died. That was like something snapped in me, and now I know it to be a total disconnect from God altogether, okay? I just completely did not understand why that God would do this, you know, why that I had to go through it. A lot of self-centeredness, you know what I mean? Why me? And I just never got over it. I know I never got over it until I got sober fully, you know, accepted it and looked at it, you know. And I blame that for a lot of my actions and a lot of my behavior in life, you know. Immediately, you know, it wasn't long after that, I started drinking. I was 12 years old, almost 13. Okay. Immediately, I started kind of separating myself from other people. You know, something, I had this belief inside of me that I shouldn't be happy, or I shouldn't be able to enjoy life because my father was just, you know, insane thinking. But for some reason, that I started really like burying myself alive inside. You know what I mean? I started separating myself from my family and other people, and I was different. That's what I remember. Right, wrong, or indifferent is my experience of when I really started. I've heard people say that they didn't really start feeling that sense of difference until they were in their teenage years. And now, you know, I didn't know this early on in my recovery, but now I remember that I was separating myself that early. As soon as, like, right after my father died, my grades went downhill. I was getting a real bad attitude. I was really involved in a lot of sports. My whole, like, crowd I was in the jock crowd. In my high school that I went to, it was like the jocks and the freaks, you know. This was in the 70s, okay? So I was starting to look at them and you know, thinking that these really weren't my friends. The people, the potheads and stuff were smoking pot and partying and drinking and cutting school and doing all that stuff. Started being real attracted to me. And I was always real attracted to the dark side, always. You know, I remember this early age. My mom told me to go right, I went left. You know, that's how it was. So I just started drinking. I don't remember when I first felt that sense of ease and comfort like the Big Book talks about. I don't have that story, you know. But I do remember going to these dances that they had. And they had bands on Saturday night in elementary school, okay? And I just remember I started drinking, smoking pot, and other things, okay? And other substances are a big part of my story as well. But I love drinking, and I loved it from the beginning. And I remember drinking, like, strawberry, Boone's Farm, and all that stuff. And whatever we could get, you know. And beer, I didn't really like. I had to force down. My father used to give me sips of it when I was a kid, and I would do it because I thought it was pretty neat and cool, you know. But I remember being at those dances and being real comfortable when I went back in, you know, going out behind the pine trees and drinking. And then going back in and being okay to dance, you know what I mean? And I knew that I wasn't okay to dance before I was drinking, you know. So that's set in my head that, you know, that alcohol will make me comfortable. Simple as that. You know what I mean? Makes me okay in the world. Might not make me perfect in the world, but makes me okay enough. A lot more okay than I was, you know. So what happened to me, it just was like a downward spiral. You know, I was hanging around. I totally dismissed my sports friends, and I was totally hanging out with this other crowd. I wanted to be accepted by this crowd, so I just drank and drugged with, you know, sheer abandon, you know, and my disease progressed very quickly, and my behavior was very bad. I got a lot of trouble, you know. I just stole and you know, took whatever I wanted. I was breaking in houses, just getting in a lot of trouble with the police. And I was 15 years old, and me and some friends of mine decided to have an acid party in this house that they just bought. These people had bought, they were moving into it. They hadn't moved in or anything, but there were fireplaces in, carpet was in. And so 11 of us had an acid party in this house, and it got a little bit out of hand. They tried to build a fire in the fireplace. Fire got a little out of hand, burned the carpet. So anyway, we all got caught for that. So, and I'd already been in trouble before that, and had been in Maryland Training School, which is a juvenile detention center. So this is when I kind of my parents started taking me to the doctors and let's see what's wrong with him. And even before this, like the year before, within that year, the time I was 14, 15, I was seeing a psychologist who was tutoring me because my grades were really bad. Excuse me. And I liked her, but I was never going to open up. I was never going to accept that there was something wrong with me, okay? And I didn't do that until I got sober. I was the angry victim my whole life. And at a very early age, I had a lot of opportunities to look at me. I had a lot of opportunities to change. I had a lot of people who cared and loved me very much, you know? My parents were good parents, you know? My mom remarried a couple years after my father died. I wanted nothing to do with that. You know, I was gone all the time. I was staying at a friend's house. My mom just never knew if I was coming home, you know. just very, very selfish of me. You know, when I look back on it now, and I've made amends to my mother and stuff, but all those sleepless nights that we steal from people, you know, and it's just a horrible way for you to live. You know, your child is gone. You know they're on drugs. You don't know what they're doing. You know, I understand how that feels today. You know, my son's drinking today, and so far I know he's just drinking and smoking pot, but you know, it's nothing I can do about it. You know, lead by example. But anyway, I just was gone all the time. I didn't want anything to do with this new family. Who are these people? You know what I mean? I am definitely not accepting you as my family. You know, I didn't want this to happen to begin with. So that's just how it was. Very defiant, self-driven. I'm out of here. Well, there's a clock right there. I see it. Trade school, juvenile detention center. After the little acid party incident, my family... They had me diagnosed at Sheppard Pratt, which is pretty much a mental hospital in Baltimore. Okay, so they agreed to admit me, pitched this in court, and said, you know, that we've had him assessed at this hospital, and we'd like him to go there instead of go back to jail. And they agreed to that. So I was at Sheppard Pratt, 15 years old. I was almost 16. Okay. Going to school there, a lot of kids my age. Drug behavior problems, you know, and I was just in full-blown denial, you know. My problem is that I have a mother who would put me in a place like this. That's my problem, you know. And Thanksgiving, my family's coming, and my little brother, he's 7 or 8 years old, you know. He's crying. He doesn't understand why his brother can't come home, you know. And I'm crying. That's feeding my crap more, you know, because I don't understand this, you know, what's wrong with me. Anytime I try to think about what's wrong with me, I just stuff it back down because nothing's wrong with me or everything's wrong with me. I don't want to look at it, you know. So dealing with all that, and it was tough, you know. And anyway, I was there. I was diagnosed to be there for 6 months. Excuse me. I'm just getting over a cold. Be there for 6 months, and ended up being there for like 10 months, okay? I was having pot mail to me in the mail, had my friends like grinding it up and folding up in letters and got caught doing that. One time I escaped, I planned this elaborate escape and escaped out of there. And I actually had some friends that were supposed to pick me up in Charles Street down to the hospital and ran all the way through the woods and got down there. They weren't there. I should have told me something right there. Maybe they think I need to be there, you know. So I stuck my thumb out and hitchhiked home, and I was back in Harford County in half an hour, you know, drinking and drinking and drinking and hanging out with the girlfriend that I had, and did that all weekend, and then realized that I had nowhere to go and nothing to do, so I might as well go back. Called my mom, she picked me up, took me back. Yeah, so 3 or 4 months later, I was just getting out of there, and it was a good experience. Though, to tell you the truth, I mean, it was. I met a lot of nice people there. A couple of the counselors that were in there, I kept in contact with. As soon as I got out, I was right back to the same crowd of people, same thing. But I wasn't like really doing a lot of really strong addictive drugs and stuff. I was just drinking a lot, you know, and partying, as we always called it. It was always partying, and I never wanted to stop partying. But I used to go back to Sheppard Pratt and visit them. You know, there were some good people that really cared. You know, they really wanted to make a difference in people's lives. And actually, when I left there, I thought about that because I was a troubled kid, you know, and I thought about what would I want to do for a career, and I thought that I would like to help troubled kids. Even though I didn't want to look at my troubles, you know, but I thought that that would be something cool to do, you know. And that's the only thing that I thought about, becoming a registered nurse in psych and working in a place like that. I thought it was a pretty neat job. So anyway, got out of there. And as I went on, I ended up back home, same people, same stuff. More trouble, stealing from my family. Mother gives up custody of me to the state of Maryland because she just cannot take it anymore. Okay, I'm 17 years old. Maryland State has custody of me. I go to a group home in Catonsville, Maryland. Okay, 17 and a half, something like that. This place was like it was almost like a college campus. So I did that. I went to the special education school because I was expelled from all county schools that could not go to a public school. And I was in a school with a bunch of kids that had the same thing. We all got expelled or something from school. And don't worry, the story gets worse, let me tell you. anyway, so I went to this special education school, lived in the group home. Same thing, no change. Getting a girl pregnant in there, growing pot in my closet. Stole some tombstones from a graveyard. I have no idea why we did that. And finally, they got sick of me and threw me out. And I was 18 years old. I was still living there. I was 18. I was actually going to Kingsville Community College at the time. And so I moved out. Got a room not far from there in Baltimore County, somewhere where most of you probably don't know. Bought a motorcycle, little street bike, was going to college. Just taking general courses, really didn't know what I was doing. Was really getting back in with my family and stuff, you know. Just kind of, you know, it's just, you know, how what I did a lot of times was I could really self-will myself to drink and control my drinking and stuff with other things, okay. And I never put, like, periods of abstinence together unless I was arrested, unless I was in jail. But at times, I could control my drinking if I was doing other things with it and I was determined to do it. But it would only last for a couple months, you know. I would drink a lot on the weekends, but there was other times during the week I could drink and stop, you know. And so back in the good graces of my family, moved back home, hooked up with my sister's best friend. Got her pregnant. We decided to get married. She decided to have an abortion. We decided to get married anyway. I mean, these are decisions I'm making. You know, drop out of school, get married at 19 years old. I have no idea what I'm doing, who I am, where I'm going in life. You know, these are just the things that I know. I'm picking these ideas up from my childhood, things that were, you know, ideas that I picked up along the way. And I'm trying to live with this, and I can't. I want to get married to this girl because I want to hold on to her forever because she's beautiful. You know what I mean? Because I don't ever know if I have another beautiful girl like this in my life. These are the kind of things. I'm going to possess her. You know what I mean? I'm thinking about what I'm going to have, and I have no idea, no way of managing any of this. You know, I have no idea how to have a relationship, how to love somebody, how to love myself, you know? So there's a lot of, you know, a lot of drinking, a lot of, you know, emotional, physical abuse type stuff. We end up together, like, probably back and forth over 7 years, you know. Same old kind of stuff. I'm in my 20s now. Things got really bad, you know, addicted to some other substances and you know, surfing from sofa to sofa. But the one thing I did do, I got into construction at an early age, okay, when I dropped out of school. And I started making really good money. Because if I really want something, I can achieve it. We're very determined people. And I made a lot of money in construction at an early age in the 80s when the market was really good. You know, the economy was really, really good. And I learned how to do it very well. So that's one of the only things that I, you know, achieved and accomplished. And I could always get things. You know, I could always get this apartment, get it hooked up. I had a Harley Davidson when I was 20 years old. You know, I wanted it, wanted to join a biker club, did that, got that, you know. And I tell you something, I was a prospect for this motorcycle club in Baltimore City called the Freedom Riders. And you know, when you're a prospect, you have to do things like wash their bikes, wash the bikes outside the bar, that kind of stuff. And they pretty much said thanks, but no thanks. You know, I was very, very violent. You know, very angry. Had a lot of anger built in me. Just any reason to pick a fight. And one time I picked a fight outside a bar. Some college kids rode by, and they said something. I said something back. They pulled over. You know, fighting to the curb, knocked over three of the motorcycles, and that was pretty much the clincher. So thanks, but no thanks. You know, that's pretty bad when a biker club's like, you're a little bit too wild for us. You know what I mean? So that's kind of how I was, and I don't think it is really cool or anything. This is how I was, you know. I knew no other way. So did that. Met my son's mother, okay? And this is getting ready to build up my first spiritual experience in life that I ever had. And at this point, I have no God in my life. I don't really believe in God. I'm telling everybody that there is no God kind of stuff. So this girl lands in my life, and I knew from before just how life works, lands in my lap. She gets pregnant, we've been together, and at this point I'm really getting really bad. I'm like, I'm a gutter kind of person, you know, and I'm thinking something's got to change, you know. People are really, even the low lace I'm hanging out with are complaining about me, and it's really waking me up. And I'm thinking, you know, I got to do something about this. And I'm looking at that, okay? So, me and this girl get his apartment. I start really, like, focusing on my job. I start really getting into this company. I'm working with this company almost a year now, which I've never done, okay? Making good money, and not really hanging out and drinking that much. We're drinking a little bit here and there. I'm really into the weightlifting now. You know, I was a real skinny kid. It was something else I was insecure about, you know, and I always wanted to be big, so I just decided to do that. I got involved in steroids and all that crap, and which was, you know, probably a big thing I had to do with breaking that marriage up. But before that all was getting out of hand, we were doing pretty good, and I was doing okay, kind of controlling my drinking, and I believe she was an alcoholic too, and she got sober years later, but we just weren't good for each other, you know? And anyway, we ended up, she got pregnant, had my son, who I still have, he's still here. And, you know, my life at the time, I'm doing steroids, okay? I'm in the gym a lot. My job's going really well. I got all that outside stuff going. You know, people are starting to respect me again. I'm getting some consistency in my life, which is making me feel a little better about myself, too. You know, but I'm starting to feel real too good about myself. I'm starting to think that I got it going on, you know, which is a very, very bad place for me, okay? So I start taking these things to the extreme, you know. I'm in the gym all the time. I'm not like cycling off the steroids. I'm staying on them. I'm getting angrier that, you know, when I'm drinking, that anger's coming up and I'm exploding, all that kind of thing. And but before any of that started really happening, when I was kind of still on top when my son was born, you know, the kind of person that I was working. I actually had to leave work and go to the hospital the day my son was born. And my mom was there. My mother-in-law was there. They're both at each corner of the hospital room, like cringing and looking and cringing. And I'm right there with my wife, you know. I'm right there with her, you know. We got married before she actually had a baby, okay. Beautiful wedding. You know, everything was like normal stuff, you know. Tuxedo, everything. Pretty good behavior, you know. And I come in the hospital room, and I'm right there with my wife, and I'm holding her hand, and I'm saying, come on, baby, you can do it, you know, and she's pushing. And, you know, when my son came out, that was like some real shit, you know what I mean? I mean, that was like real God's beauty right in front of me, you know, God's work, you know, and it was a big moment of clarity for me, you know. I was like, wow. This is a person, you know, that's formed, and I'm holding him, and I guess I didn't bring a drink up with me. It was real powerful, you know. And for a second, I believed in God, you know. And I hung out there at the hospital for a while, and then I left. And I remember going home, and I did some bong hits. You know, I sat down, I did some bong hits, and I ate some dinner, and I drank a couple beers. And I just kind of like, you know, kind of lived in that for a couple days, you know, and that was awesome stuff. And then that weekend I went out, you know, I think it was 3 days later, and my wife was staying with the baby, and I went out with her brother. Thanks, man. And I went out with her brother, my brother-in-law, which, you know, we were completely bad for each other. He was a raging alcoholic. So we're at this bar, and I run into some people, and we're partying, celebrating, and run into my first wife. Ended up sleeping with her that night while my wife's home with my baby, you know. That's the kind of person I was, okay. When the experience was laid in front of me, I was going to take it. And, you know, just how it was. And so And then after that, like I shared, it just got worse and worse. You know, got really bad. The steroids, the drugs, the drinking, the people, the selling of those things. My life was really, really unmanageable. Okay, at this time of life, I was I got an apartment. I was making money at work, and I was making money selling things. I had an apartment. I was trying to work out things with my wife. I had a girlfriend who was a barmaid at a strip club. I'm selling steroids. I'm stealing money. They're ripping people off. I stole a walk with $5,000. These guys' money. There was the wrong people to steal from. They were looking for me. I was facing. I got in a fight with a guy who would not let up. I hadn't been drinking long. I'd only been drinking for maybe an hour. He'd been drinking all day, and he would not let up. And finally, I ended up kind of exploding on him and pulled a charge that I was facing 20 years for and maximum. All that was going on at once, you know. And I had this great idea to go to North Carolina. My sister lives in Charlotte. Go down there, work for my brother-in-law. She came up for a holiday, and in an instant, you know, my life was just total freaking chaos. And I was in North Carolina in the middle of nowhere, straight up Baltimore City. Like, what am I doing here? You know, and they lived on a lake, Lake Norman, which his business was doing very well. He had a sign company. I mean, a wine cellar in the basement, refrigerator full of beer, cases stacked warm in the basement, bottles of liquor. I didn't know anybody down there. And I'm going to tell you, when I drank and there was nothing else there, I drank like that was my last drop of alcohol. And I'm telling you, man, I was all of a sudden, I'm drinking everything around me, and I'm skiing on this lake behind this brand new freaking ski boat, you know, thinking, how did I get here, you know? But anyway, you know, the point is, it's a perfect opportunity. My family's willing to help me. They were always willing to help me if I was willing to, you know, try to change. And I meant it. You know, I think we all mean it a lot of times where we really, you know, want to be different. You know what I mean? I didn't want to be a crud ball. You know, I really wanted to be a good person inside, you know. But I had all this crap covering it up. So, anyway, I ended up being thrown out of my sister's house. My brother-in-law had to actually, they got an apartment for me. He packed everything in his pickup truck and sent me to an apartment to get me out of there because I was just, like, getting real resentful and attitudish and ungrateful, and you know how it is. So, anyway, you know, that ended up being 7 years. I got to hurry up and get sober. That was 7 years. 7 years down there. And when you're away from home like that, you know, I was traveling back and forth, flying, driving to see my son every couple months. If it wasn't holiday, I was going back to see him, and that just that killed me being away from him. And it was just a lot of pain, you know, a lot of pain that I went through down there. And I just drank and tended bar and worked a lot of doors and bounced and all that stuff. And had a lot of fun. I did, you know. I had a lot of fun in my life. You know, I did a lot of fun things before it got not fun. You know, I was a skydiver for a while. I love that. I've had it going on so many times. And Bill talks about that I've arrived 10 times in my life. You know, I've been on tour buses, partying with people. I mean, I had a girlfriend who worked for Joe Gibbs Racing in Charlotte and Tony Stewart, Bobby Labonte, and she got the best seats. And I'm not a NASCAR fan, but it was still pretty cool. You know, the seats that we got, free beer, free liquor, free food, concerts, backstage, you know, partying with Fred Durst, Metallica, Dave Matthews Band, on the stage of Dave Matthews Band, on the tour bus, drinking Heineken's with her own nitrous tank. I mean, crazy stuff, you know. And so, but you know what? All that time, I never knew who the hell I was. You know, I never knew who I was. And it was all about everything else but living. You know, it was all about everything else being responsible. So, moved back up here. And I'm gonna get sober real quick here. I'm going to skip some stuff. And this always happens. But I ended up with a pesky little heroin habit when I first came back from Charlotte. And it was just something that I started doing. And this was my first attempt to get clean. And I say I'm a first nighter, and I still believe I'm a first nighter, okay, because I did no steps when I first went into any kind of meetings, okay. And I was the kind of person who was never going to do AA. You got to be kidding me. AA, no way, you know. When I started going to meetings, I got clean and went to outpatient, and I had to go to meetings. Okay. Now, I did see people that kind of had their crap together, you know. A couple guys had motorcycles. They looked good, you know what I mean? And you could tell that they were sober. That was attractive to me. Got some outside stuff back, and they're staying clean. I didn't think I would ever want to do it. So that lasted 2.5 months, okay? The girlfriend that I had from North Carolina that is in my life, that's not in my life, but we're still friends, but we were back and forth for like 14 years after I came back here and up until that I got clean, really got clean. But anyway, we were doing a long-distance thing. We were back together. I was back in the gym. I got big again. I had a job. I was running a job down in Baltimore County, big job. 2.5 months sober, raving, stark raving crazy, you know. I was so rigid and tense and angry and did not know what was wrong with me. I'm doing the steps in my head, you know what I mean? I don't have a sponsor. I don't understand that. I don't know what they're talking about, God's will. I don't have a clue. People, you know what I mean? I really didn't. Power? We talking about power? This is how I thought. I don't know what power means, you know. So I'm not praying or doing anything. So my girlfriend works with that race team, and she's supposed to come up for the weekend and see me. And last minute, I was down Baltimore running a job down the city at University of Maryland Hospital, and I'm up at Lexington Market, and she calls me and says that she can't come up last minute. This was Friday. Can't come up. Kid Rock's coming in town. I have to be with him and walk him around the infield of the race Sunday and all this stuff. And I'm like, you're nuts. You got to be up here. You know, you've got to come up here and fill my hole. I need this. You know what I mean? This is the only thing that's giving me any kind of sanity, any kind of relief. You know? So I zap out. I break the freaking receiver and the payphone inside this big eatery place. You know, that's where I'm at sober. You know, 2.5 months. I'm not getting better. I'm getting worse. Okay, and that told me right there that sobriety is my problem. Not drinking and drugging is not my problem. And that was my solution for a long time. A long, long time. So I actually got to a point at the end of that where I was laying in bed at night and I said, there's no way I can do this anymore. Tomorrow I'm drinking. And I made that decision. And I'm going to tell you what, there is some freedom in that. There was some freedom in that because I knew that it was going to be over. I knew the voices in my head was going to stop. I knew the anxiety and the pain that I was feeling was going to be relieved for at least for a little while, you know. So that that led up, that I didn't get bad really right away, but that led up, I went back out for 5 more years. It got really, really bad. The girl that was from North Carolina ended up moving up here. Bought a house, had teenage kids that I've known since they were 7 or 8, and they were like probably 17, 19 by then. And I had a good job. I'm on a methadone program, worst decision I ever made in my life. And it just got worse. It just got really, really bad for me. And I just lost any inkling of who I was. I lost all of it, everything. I had nothing. And so I lost all that. I was homeless, running around with a real sick girl, my methadone program, sleeping in her cars. This is where I was, putting anything that I could in me, and none of it was working, okay? A lot of alcohol, a lot of everything else. And unless I was completely numbed out, I was miserable, completely suicidal. And this is what I did for like a week, my last week or two. And you hear Lewis talk about this, that I would wake up to the reality of my life. Immediately, I would start crying. Immediately. Try to get together somehow. Go down to my methadone program. Get that. And then go drinking and get whatever else I could the rest of the day. However I needed to have, whatever I needed to do to get it. To keep myself completely numbed out from the reality of my life and myself and what I become. Okay? So, ended up in Baltimore County Detention Center on an assault charge. And that is when first time I got on my knees since I was probably 11 years old, okay? And I cried, and I apologized to God, and I asked for help, and I meant it at the time, you know? And I believe that started my spiritual journey, even though I went back out. I got out a couple hours later. But something inside me knew that I was going to get sober, and I knew that I was going to straighten my ass up, and I knew I was going to grow up, and I was going to try to change, okay? And I did that. So I asked my parents for help. Finally, at this point, my family's not even answering my phone calls, nothing. Everybody's cut me off. I have no friends, no family. Nobody's willing to help me. I'm totally back in the corner, nowhere to go, nowhere to go but to face who I am. My family helps me. I go there and I detox for 3 weeks before I even go into treatment. In my mom's kitchen, I have this moment of clarity, a huge moment of clarity that said that you are the problem. Okay? 41 years old, all the problems and the trouble in your life you have caused, okay? Bad things happen to good people, all that. It was a huge moment of clarity. And I don't know if I would have got it if I hadn't had that. I don't know if I would have got the willingness to change. So, obviously I was in a desperate place in my life. Like Bill Wilson says in his story, the quicksand stretched all around me. Alcohol was my master, you know. I'd been defeated, all that kind of stuff. And so I went to treatment, went to a recovery house in Bel Air called the Man House. And, you know, the day that I got out of treatment, the day that I got out, I drank. You know, I was feeling better. I hadn't slept the whole time I was in there. They were pounding, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, everything into me. And I got called up the obsession and compulsion, and I drank. And that was the last time that I drank. I knew then that there was a better way. And I knew then that this is not what I wanted to do. And I had a choice. I could go back to that girlfriend, or I could have went on and did what I did. And I took this journey that I'm on now. And it's been the hardest thing I've ever done in my life, no doubt. But it's been the most beautiful journey and the most beautiful. I have the most beautiful life today, and I'll talk a little bit about that. But so it wasn't really. I had nothing when I got to the halfway house. I had nothing. I had no dignity. I had no self-respect. I had nothing. I knew how to make my bed. I had to cook meals. I knew how to shower, all that kind of stuff. But I had nothing else. I didn't know how to look people in the eyes. I didn't know how to be social. I didn't know how to be nice. And I still had a lot of anger that I was unaware of. You know, I really only made it myself. And people used to say that, you know, after my first year and later on, they're like, you know, you were just really unapproachable. You were really angry in the beginning, you know, and I didn't feel that way. I just wanted a hug. You know what I mean? I just wanted somebody to hug me, but I was, you know, and I look back on after a couple of years, I really remember that, you know, I was angry. I was so angry at myself. I had so much shame built up. And that I'd done this to my life. I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. That I had to be sober the rest of my life. This was all the kind of things that, you know, life's gonna be boring, you know, and all that stuff. And it's been quite the opposite. But so you know, besides the fact that anger was always my most comfortable emotion, you know, and it was a defense mechanism that I used to intimidate people and keep people away from me and all that stuff, you know. And, that's really not who I am today. And so anyway, I did that. But the thing I want to say is the level of desperation that I had was gave me enough willingness to open my mind and open my heart. And when I started going to meetings, I actually started listening, and I started listening to the people talk about how they felt and how they acted and how they behaved. And more importantly, I started believing them, because I never believed anything anybody had to say. If it didn't come from my head, you're full of crap. You know, all this. I just didn't trust anybody or believe anybody. But I started believing because I couldn't discount it. And so this one guy I was talking about, this one guy said, you know, I was waiting for the mothership to come down. I thought that I was an alien. I felt like I was an alien. This guy had a lot of time, like 12, 13 years or something. And I related to that, you know. I don't mean like I felt alienated from my family. I mean, I really felt like I was from Pluto or something. These are the thoughts that I had. Maybe I'm not even human. You know what I mean? And I know that's kind of normal with us. But that's how disconnected and separate that I felt. And that's what my ego had done to my disease. You know what I mean? My alcoholism had totally separated me. I'm terminal, total terminal uniqueness. My case is different. I had all that. Steps aren't going to work for me. You know, I believe they work for other people. I'll do them anyway. And I did them, and they started working, you know, and I started getting better, and a lot changes in the first year, you know. And so anyway, I dove right in with this, you know. I did a fifth step by the time I had 4 or 5 months. Didn't really feel it right away. I knew when I was I knew I was an alcoholic, okay? Powerlessness to me is, the way that I can describe powerlessness is when I put alcohol into me, everything in me lights up like a Christmas tree. You know what I mean? Every cell in the hair that I used to have just bam, bam. You know, my brain lights up like a Christmas tree. And says, give me more of that. I need more of that. And I want the fourth drink more than I want the first drink. You know, and it never stops. I was a binge drinker. I would binge for a couple months, really heavy. Okay. Something would always stop me. It was either the police, I ran out of money, girlfriends would leave me, jobs would fire me. I never stopped myself. Once I started that ball rolling, it never stopped. And then I could clean myself up for a while. I could do that for a couple months. You know, get back in the gym, take care of myself. I just did that over and over and over and over again. Got things, lost things. You know, just so anyway, that was powerlessness to me. I knew I was an alcoholic. You know, I knew my life was unmanageable. I knew that I had surrendered. I knew that it was here. You know, it was in my heart, and I was okay with staying sober for the rest of my life. Okay, I was okay with that. Second step, when I started getting into the steps about God, I really, the things in the big book that talk about who am I to say there is no God really hit home with me. It's poking right through my self-centeredness. Who the hell am I to say there is no God? You know, a God of my own understanding. You know, that was a big moment of clarity too. You know, wow, I can really pray to something that is... I had abandoned a lot of old ideas about God and religion and all that stuff too. And that's what I did, you know. And it turns out that you know, I'm praying to an all-powerful, all-loving God, you know, that loves me unconditionally and helps me live in this world, you know, happy for the most part, content and peaceful for the most part. You know, all those voices in my head are always there. They can get there. You know, they were starting to come in on the way up here. You know, so that kind of stuff really hit home with me with God, and I just started doing it. You know, and I started doing it and seeing what happens. And I really got connected with God. I had a personal relationship with God, not just, you know, through other people and helping other people and everything, but a personal relationship. You know, I was really believed and had faith and trusted. You know, that this is how things work and all that kind of stuff. And when I did my third step prayer, my first third step prayer. What that meant to me was at the time that I was embarking on a spiritual journey, you know, that I'm going to surrender my will, I'm going to surrender my ways, and I'm going to try to, you know, give my heart to God, you know, and that's how I took it. Now, I was under some false impressions, you know, along the way that God was going to completely take care of me as long as I stayed sober, you know. I had a lot of some misconceptions that things that ideas that I gave myself that, you know, everything's going to work out. I'm just going to stay sober. Everything's going to keep getting better and better and better. You know, not the case. You have to do some work. But at the time, when I got on my knees, I meant it. You know, God, take all of me. You know, and I did a 4-step, and that was hard. It was really hard for me because I really had a lot of emotional problems. I didn't want to look at myself. I would do it, put it down, do it, put it down. Finally, one weekend, I did it. And, you know, I just didn't feel as different. You know, my sponsor's laughing for some of the stuff, and he's like, he relates and all that. And, you know, you all have heard that. But the main thing about it was, you know, the message behind all that was, I knew this is who I was, and I knew that this is who I don't have to be anymore. You know, and that's what I wanted. And I had the willingness to not be that guy anymore, you know. And, you know, things started working out for me, you know, really well. Then, you know, I made a decision to this I'll call hard lesson number one with women and relationships. So at 5.5 months, I'm senior resident of this halfway house, and I'm starting to get my ideas, you know, and missing female companionship, sneaking around a little bit, you know, for a weekend, And at this point, like, I don't even want to throw a cigarette butt in the ground at this point. I'm trying to walk on water here, you know what I mean? And that's how I was. I was trying to be too perfect and all that, and we learned that stuff too. Anyway, so I got honest about it. You know, I spent the weekend with her, supposed to be my sister's and my mom's, and, you know, I just did a fist step. I didn't want any guilt and shame piling up. I didn't want to feel any of that stuff. I'm honest today. Told them myself they had no choice but to kick me out, okay? So this is the girl who I still have an active restraining order against, okay? Who was on the Suboxone maintenance program, and me and her, two acts against the world, we're going straight to the moon, you know what I mean? And all dramatic and shit. And so that lasted about 3 weeks. And, she's trying to climb out of my Jeep on the Baltimore Beltway, and I told her that she wasn't clean, and I didn't think she was clean, and that she didn't like hearing that, and that was crazy. So I moved in with my parents and stayed there for about 10 months, and I went on to learn three more hard lessons with relationships, you know. I didn't date around. I didn't, like, do any cruddy stuff with girls, but I had three more relationships, and I learned a lot from them, and I've looked a lot at myself through all that stuff, and I've learned so much about it, and I have a big-time respect for that. It's a lot of responsibilities in relationships, and I took that for granted. This is not playing around kindergarten, high school, you know, and now when I think about somebody who, you know, I'm interested in or they're interested in me, I think about the other person today, which I never did. You know, how would I harm her, you know? And today I've been single for I don't know, 9.5 months, and it's the best thing I did. I took some time for me. And I would take some time, 2-3 months in between relationships, no other girls, no contact, get really connected spiritually. And then somebody smile at me, and there I go again, you know? And, you know, I made some mistakes. I had two girls in early recovery. One had 2 months, one had 3 months, and I had a year and a half, 1-2 years of the other one. And, you know, I had to walk through a lot of gossip and all that stuff. And I really rationalized that stuff because I'd never been in AA. I didn't really understand it, you know. Some people are sicker than others. You know, some people are really good actors. You don't really know. It's, you know, so all those things rationalized. It really was, this is what I wanted, so I did it, you know. And, so you learn some of those lessons the hard way. But we'll talk about today. what I'm like today is, I'll say, a 180 degrees different person than I was. And my old grand sponsor was saying, he said, yeah, some people's 180 degrees is a lot broader than others. Some people's 180 degrees is just a little, you know, they don't have a whole lot of changing to do. But I've always continued to look at myself and continue to do the work and do the digging, you know, and the unlearning, you know, and this prayers, you know. I'm reading a lot of stuff about Buddhism now. I'm not a Buddhist, but I've read a lot of stuff about Christianity and all of it's helpful. It's all the same principle stuff, you know. I'm not a spiritual giant, but I'm completely in love with God, and that's something that's really beautiful for me to say that, you know. And there's a lot of times that I put expectations on people, and I can be kind of reactive towards people, you know, but I know that about myself, and in the end, it's always about me and God, and I know that. And this year has been a lot of lessons learned about that. You know, I look around AA sometimes, and like, these people stand up there and they're talking about this crap and they're doing this. You know what I mean? We were talking about on the way up, and I can get real self-righteous about that because today I'm living clean, you know, and I can get real on that, on my high horse. And I have to realize that Kevin always says, you know, bless them, change me, you know. And I've learned my lessons, and you can't change people, you know, love them anyway, you know. And in the end, it's love them anyway. It never was about them. Like Mother Teresa said in that prayer, it was never about them anyway. It's about you and God, you know. I'm really, you know, knee-deep in helping people. I have a halfway house now, and it can be very stressful at times because people's lives are involved, and I have to kick people out, and I have to be really tough, and you have to, you know, have really hard skin. And Kevin's my house manager, and he's more diplomatic, and it's hard, you know. Some of those things are really hard. Dealing with people has been is the hardest thing, probably the hardest thing ever that I've had to deal with in life. And I try to be better at it, you know. I try to be, you know, more loving and less reactive and more kind and all that stuff. But the prayers work. They always work. You know, I had this epiphany. I'm running out of time, but let me say this real quick that this is how God talks to me for different ways, you know. And when I pray and I'm about something, like the other day I was praying about with these people and just let it go, David. Just ask God, just give it to God, you know. And God, please take this self-righteousness away. And the next thought that I had was, until you change these things in yourself, they will continually be a problem. Something like that. Immediately. And to me, that's God, you know. Even though I think I'm a lot better at this, I do these things a lot less, I still do them. And I'm still human, you know. And that's how God talks to me. You know, one time I was praying, I was saying, you know, I just want to be more comfortable around people. You know, God, please help me be more comfortable around people. Next thought, be more comfortable around people then. You know? So, and you know, and God just, you know, directs me in different ways in my life. I'm just aware of this stuff. You know, I try to stay spiritually awake, you know, and not get caught up in the fog of my ego and the negativity and all that stuff, you know. But I absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love coming up to meetings like this. And we you know, what else are you going to do when you're sober? My brother's like, well, what are you going up there for? Share a message of hope. Why are you going all the way up there? Because I was asked. You know, people are such information junkies. You know what I mean? My mother, man, will just sit there and a million questions. You know, it's funny how their ideas are in other ways. But anyway, thanks for letting me share.